Welcome! This is a third episode of the True Raven session on animism, shamanic journey, and therapeutic shamanism with Paul Francis. Today, we will dive deeper into symbolism of things we encounter in shamanic journeys. Hi, Paul. How are you?
Hi, Kaya. I'm good, thank you.
This is a really interesting topic, right? A big topic.
It is a big topic, yeah. It's one I get asked about a lot by students. So where do you want to start?
As we learned in previous interview, the shamanic reality is divided in three realms: the upper world, the lower world, and the middle world. What we experience there in journeys is mythos, so metaphorically true. And to unpack it, we need to research the symbols that appear and their meaning. If you could quickly recap, how do we make sense of them?
Shamanic reality is about mythos, so it's mythologically true. It's not literally factually true. And so that means that we have to spend time interpreting it, making sense of it. It's not just spelt out for us. So in terms of how to go about doing that, the first thing I want to say is about the power dynamic. So I don't do one-to-one work anymore, but when I was, and certainly though with working with students, if they're asking about what happened in a journey, my first question is, what does it mean for you? We live in a culture with a very screwed up relationship with power, essentially. We're used to relationships that are power over and powerlessness and handing our power away and so on and so on. And I don't want to work in any ways or teach in any ways that perpetuate that. So I'm always interested in trying to help people find their own power, so their own meaning to things. I'm not interested in interpreting people's journeys. I'm interested in helping them unpack journeys for themselves. Whether it's helping somebody unpack their journey or whether it's unpacking our own journey, there's essentially two different ways we can approach this, a right brain way and a left brain way. Okay, so the right hemisphere of our brain is the part that journeys, and that part of us is the mythological part, the part that works in symbolisms and meanings like that. So with that part of our brain, it is often about getting a sense of what does this mean to you. So somebody says, oh, you know, I saw such and such in a journey. You know, what's your sense of that? How did you feel when that appeared? So that part of us much more comes from intuitions, gut feelings, noticing body reactions and so on. The left brain has its place as well. And the left brain is much more about information, facts and knowledge, essentially. It's a misconception Westerners often have when they get into shamanic work, that kind of knowledge has no place, essentially. People can get quite sniffy about the idea of looking up meanings in books or on the internet or something, so if that's somehow not shamanic or something. And that's nonsense. In a shamanic culture, you would have obviously been taught how to journey and have the direct experience, but you would also have been taught a lot of facts as well. There would have been a substantial body of knowledge that you would have had to rote learn and things. You would have been taught about the healing properties of this particular kind of tree or the teachings of this particular animal and so on and so on. There would have been a lot of knowledge to learn. So the left and right brain both have their places. Right brain stuff, yeah, what does this feel like? How did I feel inside? What emotional reaction did I have? What's my gut telling me? Left brain stuff, look it up on Google. People that say, oh, I only want to trust my own feelings about things. I don't want to read anybody else's interpretation. It's a kind of another example of modern human narcissism, really. We live in a very me culture, I culture. In an indigenous culture, you would have had a lot of respect for the elders who've gone before you and the ancestors before you and their knowledge and teaching and their experiences. Looking stuff up, yes, a lot of what you find out there is going to be nonsense and you have to have your bullshit detector with you. But there's still a lot of collective wisdom and teaching we have that we can draw on and should respect as well.
A lot of allies in the nature, right?
Well, extraordinarily. Your journey is a basket of gifts for you to learn about and unpack.
So is everything that appears in a journey just a symbol, or is it more than it?
No, it's absolutely not just a symbol. I mean, on one level, it can be a symbolic, but if you just think of things as being symbols, you are humanizing everything, essentially. Everything's just then some tool for your personal development or something. The things that appear in journeys are not symbols. They are actual, real beings, independent beings. They are real, sentient, aware creatures. Yeah, that's really important. I see a lot of practitioners who get stuck in that human narcissistic bubble, essentially. Particularly, I mean, it's something a lot of psychotherapists sometimes want to do is reduce everything down to just this is imagination or the unconscious or something. It's, if that's the way you approach it, then that is all it is. And the and there'll be lots of useful stuff come out of that, but the true, vast, immeasurable, immense depth of animism will forever evade you until you really take a board. These are real, sentient, independent beings with their own wisdom.
So symbols can appear in the form of an animal, plant, or stone. Does also the environment that symbols appear in hold a meaning? Does it, for example, make a difference if a particular stone appears in a forest or underwater or at the mountain?
It does. When I started journeying, I mean, I learned quite early on to start looking up each plant, each animal, each stone and so on. But it wasn't really till I started doing lots of journeys for other people that I woke up to environments. There's particular environments I'm comfortable in. I'm not a hot weather person at all. I like mountains, I like pine forests and so on. So a lot of my journeys tended to be in those kind of environments. So when I started a journey for other people, it was really shocking to emerge into the low world and be in a really humid tropical rainforest, which is my idea of hell in this reality. It shocked me out of my own comfort zone, for one thing. It expanded my experiences. But the thing I started asking myself is, why? Why? I'm journeying for this person. Why are we in a tropical forest? Or why are we in a desert or something? There must be a meaning to this, yeah? But so I started researching environments, not just the things in them, essentially. I did this again through right brain and left brain. So I deliberately started journeying to different environments in the lower world. And I did a lot of research as well on them, the meaning of desert and the meaning of mountain and the meaning of grassland and so on and so on. And yeah, it was very, very interesting what came out of all that, really.
Can you maybe give me some examples of what you found?
Lots and lots and lots of things came out of it. So one example is, broadly speaking, you can classify environments as being sea, land, sky and air. And what became pretty apparent was there's an interesting correlation between them and the four elements, which are a big part of many cultures' shamanic work as well. So water, correlation with sea, land with earth, air with air, sky, and fire with fire, of course. The underworld.
Could you tell me a bit about each of them? Let's start with sea, for example.
Before saying any of this, I want to just reiterate what I was saying earlier about not to get too interpretive about things or too literal. It's like these are possibilities. Yeah, so you can't say somebody's journeyed about sea, it means this. That's not the point. It's maybe it means this. Let's think about this. Okay. So that being said, the sea, there's lots and lots of aspects to the sea. Let's just take one of them. So as well as obviously being about water and the water element and all that that's about, another aspect of it often is mother. Because if you accept the theory of evolution as animals, as far as we know, we originated in the sea. That's where we came from. The sea was our original mother. Interestingly, mineral composition of the fluid in each cell of our body, the lymph fluid, the cerebrospinal fluid that our brain and spinal cord are floating in, and amniotic fluid. All of that is chemically extremely similar to seawater still. In many ways, although we've left the sea, in some ways we are a bag of seawater, essentially, moving around the land. Although it isn't always about this in journeys, but it's a possibility to consider. So if you find yourself going into the sea in journeys or emerging in the sea, it might be because there's some healing needs doing around your mothering, either your own mother or being a mother, or on a bigger sense, just about belonging generally. So that's one aspect of the sea that's really fascinating, is around mothering. And leaving the sea can be symbolic of leaving that first healthy attachment. And there's a grief in that as well. And tears, of course, are salty. Lots and lots of things to explore with the sea. It's when it comes up in a journey, it's like,
So if sea is the archetypal mother, which element and corresponding environment works as archetypal father?
Well, we've got two candidates for that. So if you're doing your left brain research, very often you'll find the land put forward as father. My personal relationship with it is it more represents the masculine, I'd say, rather than father necessarily. I want to clarify, when I'm talking about masculine and feminine, I'm not talking about men and women here. I'm talking about the sacred masculine, the sacred feminine. So, you know, we all have the masculine and the feminine within us if we're healthy. So if we're talking about the sort of principles of the feminine, things like sort of being receptive, yielding, flowing, all that sort of stuff that water and the sea symbolises, the masculine is more defined and rigid and unyielding and unbending and structured and ordered and things. So the land represents a lot of more masculine qualities in relation to the sea. I mean, obviously, every environment has the masculine and feminine within it, but if the sea overall is more mother feminine, the land overall is more masculine. The other big candidate, though, is sky. So in shamanism, we talk a lot about the lower worlds as being Mother Earth and the sky as being father, essentially. And again, it has some of those qualities of the masculine as well, being a bit more aloof, detached, a bit cooler, a bit more distant. So, yeah, two candidates for the masculine, really, the land and the sky.
So sea, land and sky. Tell me more about the remaining environment corresponding to fire.
Yeah, fire's a really interesting one. Unless you live in a volcanic region, it's not apparent to most people. But we are living on a, you know, in geological terms, a very thin crust that floats on fire, essentially. It's all going on beneath us. And that's the nature of it. The fire represents the unconscious, the stuff that's hidden, and that every so often will burst through into consciousness. One of my favourite quotes from anybody all time ever is a quote from Carl Jung. One doesn't reach enlightenment by imagining figures of light, but by making the darkness conscious. In other words, the hero's journey, the journey towards wholeness, involves a descent into the underworld, if you like, into the unconscious. And that's the realm of fire. And the other thing with fire is it's transformative. So a descent into fire in a journey can be very symbolic of that need to go into the unconscious, to be willing to submit to being taken apart and completely reformed, essentially. The other thing I'd also mention with the fire element is about power. In this culture we live in a society that's got a very screwed up relationship with power. So fire appearing in dreams can also be a message about learning to use your power better. So hope that gives a flavour. So the different kinds of environment, sea, sky, land and fire, the underworlds, can be trying to tell us something about the wounds we need to heal.
What if in a journey you find yourself transitioning from one environment to the other? For example, from land to sea, does that have any special meaning?
It's absolutely something that would make me sit up and pay attention. The transition between things is usually a very powerful thing. It's something shamans have always had a real fascination for, that the space between things, the cracks between the worlds, the openings. And so in some ways for me, the transition from one realm to another is even more interesting than the realm itself. It's something I really pay attention to. give you a couple of examples. So you're in a journey on the land and you come to the sea. So what could that going into the sea be symbolising? Again, if you know the possibilities, it's going to help you unpack it potentially. So it might be that you've got mother wounds you need to address or attachment issues. So it's a going back to facing those wounds. It could be issues about grief you need to start addressing and face. Could be learning to be more emotional, of course, because the sea's water is also about going with the flow and emotions and not holding on and stuff. It could be about being less masculine or less land, less structured, less definitive, less logical, less rational, and embracing emotions, flow, flux, uncertainty, feelings, including grief. It could be all sorts of things. Interesting question then is, in the journey, how far did you get? Did you just stay on the beach and stare out to sea? Or did you go into the sea? How far did you go into sea? Did you just splash around in the shallows? Yeah. Or did you actually let go of the land altogether and take the plunge? Yeah. How did that feel? Yeah. And then how far did you go? What about the really, really deep sea? The really deep, dark, unconscious? Similarly, you're in the sea, what's coming onto land about? Maybe it's time to be more masculine, more to let emotions go a bit more, to get some structure, to set off, explore new realms, things all sorts of things. So the transitions are really, really interesting. Another really interesting one for me is transition, say, from land to air. Obviously, birds do that one well as a whole. Often overlooked, though, are insects. I mean, insects are really fascinating in that most insects, there are exceptions, but they have four stages to their life. So egg, then some kind of grub, caterpillary thing, depending on the insect, and then a period in a cocoon, a chrysalis, which is a profound and radical transformation, and then usually a flying insect. In many ways, insects, somebody once said to me, they're almost like the remedy for the times we live in a way, because they spend a lot of their life in the grub stage just eating, consume. Maybe occasionally they may gaze up at the sky and sort of wonder, but then it's back to eat, consume. And most of them never get any further. Most of them just die, get eaten or, never get past that stage. Some of them manage to go to a cocoon, to go through that transformation. And then when they do, they can emerge and take flight. Yeah. That transition, that yearning for sky, to have that perspective and things, birds, insects, great teachers around that, and that movement up. And then all of them have to come back down, though, to mate. Mm. Yeah, and find food, most of them. Yeah, there's so much teaching about the transitions between the realms and the animals that model that for us as well.
What about the environments we find within realms we just explored? For example, grasslands, mountain regions, coral reefs. Do they have any further, even more specialised meaning, maybe?
So as well as the sort of broad brushstrokes of air, land, sky and sea, yes, of course, within that there's environments. There's the ones as land mammals, animals we're familiar with. So as you mentioned, forests, grasslands, mountains and that sort of thing. The sea as well has masses of different kinds of environments in it as well. You know, the shoreline is very different to further out on the continental shelf, which is different to the far ocean, which is very different to the deep ocean, and so on and so on. So there's lots of different environments. As I say, when I started a journey for other people, I started to encounter environments that I wasn't naturally drawn to or comfortable with necessarily or familiar with. So I did start to very deliberately do journeys to explore these. So I did journeys to savannas, to tropical forests, to deserts, all sorts of things. What I discovered is that they all have energetic qualities. They have a feel to them. They that's full of richness and meaning, if you can learn to tune into it.
This seems like there is a lifetime worth list of environment to journey to. Are there any environments you would especially recommend to shamanic practitioners to start with?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lifetime of environments to explore and a lifetime exploring probably to do in any one of them. And that's part of the beauty of this work, is it's just endlessly fascinating, and you can just go deeper and deeper and deeper into things. In terms of particular things that are worth exploring, though, to deepen your relationship with your power animal, to explore its environment. Now, I mean, I said earlier, I'm really not a fan of heat. Tropical forest, damp humid tropical forest, is absolutely not something I ever physically in this middle world want to set foot in. My power animal is panther, which that's its environment. So to bond with panther, I spent a lot of time journeying with panther to explore how panther experienced its environment. I started to notice then was what it was eating, like capybaras and caimans and turtles and all sorts of things. And then I deliberately did journeys. What's it like to be a capybara? What's it like to be a caiman? Yeah, what's it like to be turtle? So as well as being panther, I became all its prey animals as well. What's its relationship with other predators in its environment? So I basically started to look at the other things in that environment and try to get to know them as well, and how they all fit together as well and form an ecosystem. That's really deepens your relationship with your power animal, in my experience. The other thing that's absolutely worth doing is your local environment as well. I mean, that's the whole point of shamanism in the end, is to reconnect with the land you live in. I mean, I live in the UK, and you know, people don't usually journey with mole or hedgehog. So I journeyed a lot with those as well, and started to reconnect with the local animals that I share this environment with. So yeah, power animals, environments, your local environment, and then just generally, I think, just environments you're not familiar with, just to stretch your shamanic experience a bit, to expand your repertoire, to take you out of your comfort zone. It's always a good thing.
If you were to mention the biggest wisdom you got from journeying to different environments, what would it be?
Well, I'll tell you one thing that really surprised me doing all this. When you start off, it's just, you know, it's very exciting hanging around with panther and being an oak tree, or, you know, it's all great, and that's how it should be. But the more you do it, the point of this is to reconnect again. As modern humans, we're very disconnected from each other. Social relationships are breaking down, you know, lots of loneliness is on the rise, all sorts of things. But we're completely disconnected from the environment in many ways as well. When you go into environments, it's often very tamed and domesticated. I spent a lot of my 20s and 30s doing mountain walking and things. It was a huge part of my life. But I approached it very much as a human going mountain walking. And I had lists of mountains that ticked off, and I had routes and, you know, all sorts of things. And I notice it when people start journeying as well. It's like they go around being a human experiencing things. So now I'm a human being a waterfall. Now I'm a human being an oak tree and so on. Not actually being the waterfall, being the oak tree. How wrapped up we are as human beings in our own little disconnection and bubble. And everything else really does experience being part of something bigger, part of an ecosystem. And that's, from what we know about hunter-gatherers, that's really how they experienced the world as well. They really experienced that they were a twig on a branch of a bigger tree of life. That's what they were. So one of the things I unexpectedly got from exploring environments was to start to feel from the inside out that sense of interconnection and how things fit together and they're in reciprocal relationship and things. So that was amazing and unexpected. But the biggest thing that came out of that was realising the environment itself is alive. It has its own soul as well. Yeah, the desert is a consciousness. Yeah, grassland is a consciousness. It's made up of constituent consciousnesses, the individual animals and plants, but they're like cells in a bigger body. The branches on a tree, Mountain has a consciousness you can talk to. The sea is a living being. Yeah, the sea is a living being. I mean, that's really, once you get that, that's beyond immense. Yeah. So that was one of the biggest things I got from this, is to re-experience the sentience of the world around me and the immensity of some of the beings who are around us. And that is to become animist again, to experience the world as an alive being, full of other beings as well, and that you are a part of it, not separate from it, not an observer of it.
That's beautiful, beautifully said.
Thank you.
You also offer a course on this that starts in October, the Shamanic Worlds. Can you say something about what students can expect from that?
My students are usually quite used to the idea of looking up individual things that happen in journeys, so individual animals and plants and so on. This is a chance to pay attention to the bigger scale, essentially, the environments as well. We will explore the environments in terms of the realms, the meaning of sea, of land, of sky, and of fire. We'll also look at broadening our repertoire, kind of getting out of a comfort zone, exploring different kinds of environments that you may be not familiar with, flora and fauna of those as well, and how they all fit together. And like I was saying, to explore these environments as being themselves living beings, living conscious beings. Along the way, when we look at sky, we'll look at bird medicine. Birds have a really special place in shamanism. Obviously, when we look at sea, we'll look at sea animals. We'll look at fire in terms of the hero's journey, essentially. You know, even if you're very familiar with low world work and with working with animal, plant and stone, this adds a whole massive layer of depth to it, really. There's whole piles more stuff to unpack and experience here. And like I say, the effect of that is to really deepen your connection and that sense of interconnection as well. It really changes you.
Can you maybe give me a few examples of journeys students will do during the course?
Yeah, so we'll do journeys to each of the realms to experience them and maybe to explore what they're about in terms of mother issues, father issues, going into the unconscious and so on. There'll be a chance, I'll offer people options because there are lots of different environments, so to pick an environment, to do a bit of research maybe on the plants and animals that live there and to actually make a list and then to journey. I'll give you one example, though, of a really amazing journey we'll be doing, which is waves in the sea. Because when we look at waves, it looks like the water is moving towards us, and it's not. Okay. What a wave is an energy pattern in the water that's travelling through the water. And so what happens, as the energy pattern moves along, each time it hits the water, that water goes up. Yeah. So what we're really seeing, yeah, is the water going up and down as this thing moves through it. Now, each wave has an amazing amount of integrity. It can actually remain intact and travel for thousands of miles and hundreds, thousands even of other energy patterns can crisscross it and it'll still remain intact. It has a real integrity to it. Things swim through it, all sorts of stuff. You know, the wind blows on it, all sorts of things. And it can carry on doing what it's meant to do for thousands of miles. So there's obvious metaphors here with the soul and all the things that can pull us off track and all the encounters we have with other things and the path of our soul. Here's the amazing thing as well. Eventually the wave will hit land and it'll cease. Being it will die essentially, and when it does that, when it hits the land, it releases, it transforms essentially. So part of it becomes heat, essentially kinetic energy, as it hits the land, it goes to the earth, and then part of it releases a sound down to the sky, which is our death, letting go to the earth and the sky again. So that a really amazing journey is actually to journey as wave. as a metaphor for your life. Yeah, all the things you encounter, things, but to keep true to your purpose, and when time comes, to release back to Mother Earth and Father Sky.
Wow, beautiful. Yeah. I think I'm gonna go make my list of journeys I need to do, because you gave a lot of interesting examples. So I guess until the next time.
Great. Thank you very much, Kaya. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.